We have ignition sequence start.
Short distance, high impact.
5, 4, 3, 2, all engines running.
10 questions with Adam Zwar. Big names, great minds.
Make yourself a cup of tea.
Liftoff, we have liftoff.
Welcome to another 10 questions. Today I'm interviewing a guy whose photo I had up on my wall when I was a teenager. But more about that in a second. I just want to bring to your attention that we're doing a special one-off performance of Agony live in Melbourne at the Yarraville Club on December 12. It stars Lawrence Mooney, Celia Pecola, Sam Pang and Michelle Laurie. And tickets are on sale at yarravillelaughs.com. That's yarravillelaughs.com. Get along if you can. Don't want to put too much pressure on this, but it might be the start of something. But back to our guest. Everybody knows Steve Izard, and Australian comedy owes him so much. There's The 11th Hour, Fast Forward, Tonight Live, all of which he wrote, produced, and starred in. He was also EP of Big Girls Blouse, Jim Owen, and The Eric Banner Show. I was about 17, and I didn't know what to do with the rest of my life, when I read an article on Steve Izard in Time magazine. I hadn't seen Tonight Live, but the article resonated with me, so I stuck the article plus the cover photo of Steve on the wall right next to the poster of tennis player Gabriella Sabatini. After that, I became a massive Izard fan, rarely missing an episode of Tonight Live and never missing Fast Forward. Then, several years later, I was lucky enough to work with Steve on The Wedge and then on 2 seasons of the Agony series. Sometimes meeting your heroes works out. Right now, Steve's written a play called Last Man Standing, which is at the Melbourne Theatre Company. And as always, I started by asking him when he was most happy.
Maybe I'm just good at eliminating the negative bits, but it seems to me my life's been full of happiness. When I was a little kid, my memories of growing up, we moved a fair bit, and I have memories of always being on a scooter and scootering around with my brother. I had a red scooter, and my brother had a green scooter, and we'd scooter everywhere. And the sun was always sunny. I mean, what age would we have been? I was 23 and he was 21. So, we still scooter everywhere. We're idiots. So I reckon I would have been about 7 or 8, and Andy would have been 6. He's 2 years younger than me, and we would just, life was like one endless summer. So I have endless joy thinking about that. I suppose I've got 5 kids. The birth of each of my 5 kids was fantastic.
Yeah,
I just got on the phone. I mean, literally sitting there witnessing the birth of new life was fantastic, and then getting on the blower to my mum and my dad and all my friends, my family, and just saying, "Oh, we've just got this, you know, little kid," and being surrounded by family at that time was just amazing. When I was about 14, I remember summer holidays where it was the most beautiful summer holidays. We were at Point Lonsdale. And I remember at that very time, I was reading Lord of the Rings. And it was just, I was immersed in this magical world for the first time. Mm. I mean, now we've all seen the films and it's so commonplace. But for a 14-year-old boy, I remember just reading this and, you know, mucking around in the waves by day and just, you know, body surfing for hours on end, you know, absolutely heedless of any skin cancer or anything. Yeah. We just got burnt at the berry in those days. And we'd lie on the beach, just get covered in sand, dry off, and then we'd go back in and body surf. And then for evenings and night, I'd read this Lord of the Rings. And now that I think about it, that was just this most magical summer of fantasy and real fantasy as well. Perfect. And what else? Oh, falling in love with my wife for the first. I mean, I remember falling in love with Sarah.
Yeah.
First time we met at a dinner party. And we were both there to be set up with these different people, and we were accidentally sat next to each other, and the other people didn't get a look in, and we just talked the whole night, and we laughed and laughed, and I thought she was beautiful and funny, and that was kind of love at first sight. And then I ended up, contrary to what the plan was, I took her back to her place. And I tried to crack onto her, and she said, I don't sleep with someone on the first date." And then, I said, "What happens if I dropped you off and came back in 20 minutes?" She said, "Oh, well, that could be," she said, "that could be different." So I probably shouldn't have divulged that. But
that's brilliant, that man. What a great line. It reminds me of that Keith Miller story where Bradman tells everyone to be in bed by during the Ashes tour in 1948, and Bradman says everyone in bed at midnight. And at 10 past 12, Keith knocks on the Don's door and said, "Don, I did what you said. I was in bed at midnight, and now I'm fucking going out."
How good was Keith Miller?
Yeah.
I'm surprised someone hasn't done a thing on him.
Yeah.
Did Keith Miller get it on with Princess Margaret? That was the story,
yeah,
wasn't it?
That, yeah, he
cracked
on to
Princess Margaret. And I remember there was a time, it must have been late in his career, when he would be brought into the commentary box on ABC radio,
yeah,
and they'd bring the great Keith Miller in, and you'd listen to the radio, and I would love listening to cricket on the radio when I was growing up. And you could always tell when Keith Miller came into the commentary box, because it was the most perceptive commentary, but it was the positions of the MCG that he described. He'd never say it's hit through cover or it's hit to square leg or point. He'd say it's hit toward the sportsman's bar. Everything was every position on the MCG was described in terms of where you could get a beer. It was the most extraordinary description of the MCG I've ever heard. He was fantastic.
The second question, Steve, who would you like to apologise to and why?
Well, you know, this is an interesting question for me because I've lived a life full of apologies. So when you ask the question, you mean someone who I haven't actually currently apologised to, because I reckon I've apologised to everyone. I've spent my life apologising to my mum, my dad, my wife, my kids, my colleagues. I've apologised. I reckon I've apologised to more people than is most people collectively, than a room full. I've apologised to newspapers, to viewers of TV shows, to lovers of comedy. You'd be hard-pressed to think of someone who should be apologised to that I actually already haven't apologised to. So I'm trying to think who's left. You know what? My younger self, when you know what it's like when you're growing up, when I was young, I was, you know, you're so full of hubris and the only person you think about is yourself. So when I was young, you'd get a job and you'd not turn up or something, and you'd let someone down. I remember I was a tutor at St. Mary's College and the nuns who ran this is at uni. So I've been put in a college and given a position of responsibility, but I'm about 23, and the only thing that I'm thinking about are women mucking around, drinking, women. and the great thing about this college was that me and my mate Curls were the first intake of blokes into this college.
Oh,
this is before
God.
We got appointed tutors. So it was an all-female college at Melbourne University, and we were invited in. So it's the first time they're going co-ed. So they took four blokes in out of like about 200 girls and four blokes. So we had to go and to Sister Elizabeth and we had to look as though I had gotten a haircut for the occasion and I looked, I was 23 and Curls and I colluded and we both dressed in these things. We looked like we were Jesuits.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we turned up at the interview and Sister Elizabeth let us in. And the beauty of this college every single night was at 9 o'clock they had this old caretaker. He looked like that caretaker out of Harry Potter.
Yeah.
And he'd lock the door at 9 o'clock every night to stop all the boys coming in, except we were the boys. There were four of us locked in this college.
Unbelievable.
It was amazing. It was like being let loose in it. It was just unbelievable.
You're blessed.
I would apologise to Sister Elizabeth. I'd apologise to half the Catholic population. I'd apologise. And the nuns were so nice to us. I mean, we let them down just so badly. I remember me and my mate Tony Rickards and Curls, you know, we were supposed to be tutoring or something and we just went away. We drove to Sydney. We actually went up Sydney Road to get a hamburger, as you do at uni. It was 11:30 at night, and Rog had an old Peugeot. And we drove up to get a hamburger at this place in Sydney Road. And we got the hamburger. We said, I wonder if we should drive a bit further. And we drove through the night to Sydney. We just drove to Sydney for no reason. Arrived in Sydney. We had a mate who was at NIDA stayed at his place for 4 days, came back, and we went to King's Cross and we saw all these strip clubs and it was like, you know, all this whole world opening up. And then we came back and the nuns, we'd missed all these chits and done all our duty and stuff like that. And I rang before we arrived back and told Sister Elizabeth a complete fabrication that we'd been fishing.
Yeah.
And she said, well, could you bring us back a fish? So we I only remembered that when we were coming back down Sydney Road and we stopped at this fish and chip shop just, you know, minutes away from the college. And you had a fish and chip shops have all those fish on ice on display in the front window.
Yeah.
We just bought an esky and filled it up with whatever they had. And we took it and the cook cooked it and the nuns made this special dinner with the fish that we'd allegedly cooked. And I thought we'd got away with this thing, saying we'd been fishing and Elizabeth, after she'd eaten it and been very nice and said, it's great to have you back, said, you must have been fishing in some very unusual places because you've managed to get freshwater fish, deep sea fish, estuary fish. they knew exactly what we were up to.
Sister Elizabeth, was it?
Sister Elizabeth. I'd apologise to Sister Elizabeth for having, you know, really not done what we were supposed to do.
I reckon she would have known what she was getting herself into. Just by the side of Rickard's one of the...
but he was a constant visitor. Why wouldn't he be? You know, he was always in there. It was just all, you know, and my friend Paul Grabowski was in there. It was just fantastic. It was, I mean, they were golden days.
Question three, what is your greatest regret?
I'm not a great regretter. I don't spend my life looking backwards because I early on formed the view that there's no point dwelling on things that you can't change, and the only thing you can change is what's about to happen. So I'm not one of the great regretters in life. I mean, I think I should. I like to learn for the future, but I don't think there's much point regretting the past. But if I did, I guess. Let me think. When I was at school, there was a teacher who was his name was Mr. Keats, and he was almost like one of those teachers you see in those films where he's teased and all the boys tease and mock him. And he was actually an incredibly good teacher. And I remember at one stage all the boys were – I went to an all-boys school, and I was a late developer, so I was just kind of – you know, I wasn't aggressive. I just sort of went around my business. And I remember at one stage – and he was an English teacher. He was inspirational in a way – and he was reading to us this quite beautiful book, and all the other boys started throwing rolled up bits of paper at him and stuff. And it was the saddest thing. The poor man, you know, he must have been stressed, but he started crying. And I remember thinking to myself, I did nothing. I actually did nothing to stop it, and I did nothing, and I just stood by and watched. And it always was with me that horrible thing about watching a mob do something and being complicit, not actually, you know, even though I didn't throw anything, I actually did nothing to stop it either. And I just felt so regretful, and I never fully understood the pain that man must have been feeling you know, what he was on about. And yet even now, now as an older man and having seen so much more of life and whatever, you know, I still feel this pain and this angst for this poor man who turned up and was trying to teach this group of hoodlums the beauty of the English language. And so, I guess that would be my greatest regret. It's a pathetic little thing, but it's something that stuck with me my whole life.
When I ask that question, a lot of people do talk about, you know, bullying that went on in school, whether they were the bully or they were standing by watching someone get bullied or something like that. And I think it's quite potent.
Of all the things in life, you see it in the workplace, you hear about it in military situations, you know, or just in plain old life, straight in front of you every day. When you see someone who's picked on or who's ridiculed, who's mocked unfairly, it's something that absolutely riles me. I mean, it's of all the things in life, it's the thing that most riles me.
Yeah, me too. Question four, Steve, what would you still need to do to feel you've lived a satisfactory life?
The answer is probably nothing, actually. I'm really comfortable with where I'm at the moment. It'd be more of the same. It'd just be variations of more of the same. I mean, the best thing in life for me is waking up on a beautiful day. I love the company of other people, not just mass numbers, a small, having a great lunch, doing something like that, immersing myself in a great book, watching a great film or a movie, seeing a great piece of theatre. Living a day for me is what I enjoy doing. And I've done that, and I continue to enjoy doing it. I mean, if I think of some great things that I'd like to do, I'm shocking. I imagine myself doing all of these things, but when it gets down to it, I kind of enjoy what I'm doing. I imagine, for example, that I wanted to go on this trek through the Austrian Alps once.
Yeah, yeah.
Because someone gave me one of those books, like 1001 Great Walks in the World. So I thought, oh, you know what? I'm going to do these. I'm going to go, you know, it was like 1,000. I mean, I couldn't do one. So have I told you about how me and Tony Rickards did this?
Yeah, you went to somewhere in Europe.
We actually did this. We booked a trip. Tony and me, who are best mates, we're each other's son's godparents. So we got the two boys, who were at that time about 14 and 13, and we took the two boys and we went to Europe, Tony and me, to do this walk through Germany and Italy. And Tony loves a drink. So we arrived at the airport with the boys, and we were driving to where we were supposed to start the walk, and we passed an inn.
Yeah.
And it was a really quite attractive looking inn. And Tony said, well, why don't we stop and have a bit of a drink before we do the walking part? So we went there. Well, then we wrote that day off, and the boys were having quite a nice time. So then we thought, well, we'll stay in this little place. So then we drove somewhere the next day, and we thought, shit, this is a nice little village. Why don't we just stay here for a day? What actually was supposed to be one of the commencement of my 1001 walks of the world turned into a pub crawl through the Austrian Alps. We heard there was this great chalet that we could go to and stay for the night, and Tony got the instructions in German from the innkeeper where we were at, because we were in the middle of Bavaria, and they didn't really speak good English. And we were driving this tiny little car. So Tony was the navigator, and I was following his instructions. He had a map with a biro line drawn on it, this bloke had drawn. So we drove, and we're going up a track, and then the road started to get thinner and thinner. And then we're really high up on the side of a mountain. And then the road petered out, and we're stuck on an angle, an unbelievably steep angle, halfway up an Alp.
God.
And we couldn't go any further. And I said, mate, we're buggered. And we stopped, and about 20 minutes later, these hikers came down the track and started pointing at our car. Tony had inadvertently steered us up a walking track. We'd taken a car up a walking track, and we were stuck. And we had to wait for all of these hikers to come to help us turn the car around. It was horrific.
Well, lifted the car and turned it around.
They helped us sort of drag the car around. It was horrible. I swear to God, I thought we were going to lose the car. The boys were really upset. That was one of the better moments of our supposed walking trip. We didn't walk anywhere. We walked nowhere.
Just to listeners, Tony Rickards is one of Australia's best character actors, and he's been on everything over the years.
Oh, he has, and a comedian as well, and a great writer, and a great mate of mine as well, and a very funny guy. Just great company.
Very funny man, and got a bit of notoriety in the 80s for his various romances.
I mean, one of them, of course, was Greta Scacchi.
who he
went out with. Tony went out with Greta Scacchi for 4 or 5 years.
Unbelievable.
And in fact, that's when he was living in Carlton, and I used to stay with him at his place in Carlton in those days. And Greta at that time, and still is, was one of the most beautiful women in the world.
Yeah.
I mean, what she was doing with Tony is just beyond belief. But I remember I'd be staying there, because you know how you sort of stay, you bot off people at their houses at that age. And Greta would come down. She had a habit of coming down nude to make herself a cup of tea or coffee or something. I'd get up at about 4 a.m. on the off chance You've never seen so many blokes wandering around a kitchen, like ambling around a kitchen just on the off chance that she might materialise. It was pathetic. And once the word got out, Roscoe would come over. There was dozens of blokes all coming over, just pottering around his kitchen for no apparent reason. And finally, Tony twigged. It was...
Does he would hear all those alarms going off at 4 a.m.? Oh, I've got to get up to see Gretanude.
I've got to go. I've got a meeting at Tony's kitchen.
Question five, Steve. Who is the person who most influenced you and how?
Look, you know, the clear answer is probably Dad. He had an extraordinary life and he was an interesting man and he was a strong personality and a good man and, you know, he raised us four kids and so I'd say I was massively influenced by my dad. He'd lived an interesting life. His father, my grandfather, had come out as one of 13 Irishmen. And they were educated Irishmen who'd been to Trinity College in Dublin. And they talked like that. And they were fantastically interesting guys. And Dad had grown up. But Dad was... my grandfather got married late. So, you know, he was an older father, my grandfather, to my father. And he was very strict, like really strict. And so Dad had started at university, just missed the war. But then they set up this thing called the Pacific Island Administration School. And it was to administer all of the Pacific Islands that Australia had been given as territories after the war. And they needed to equip them with people. And they wanted these young patrol officers to administer them. So they were effectively magistrates, explorers, anthropologists, all in one. So as a 23-year-old, he went to this place called Kerama in New Guinea. It's called the Gulf region.
Yeah.
And it went right up through the Fly River, the Sepik River, all the way up into the highlands. And they were charged with exploring it. It was uncharted. It was off the map. There was no maps of it. And during his lifetime up there, he encountered people he'd never seen white people before. I mean, he had arrow marks in his legs from where he was fired upon by these people. Never seen them. They're pygmies called the Kookookookas. I've got photos that Dad took with his camera. And they'd go on these huge expeditions. It was like something out of Rider Haggard, you know, King Solomon's Mine. They'd go on these expeditions that went 200 days into unexplored territory. And every day they'd hack through the jungle and they'd stop, set up camp, and they had their native porters and just three white guys and, like, you know, 40 native porters going through. And they'd arrest and they'd explain how justice worked and they'd tell people how to set up their villages. And it literally was sort of colonialism meeting, native culture.
That's amazing.
It was amazing. And Dad's diaries and records of it are extraordinary. His photo albums of it are extraordinary. Yeah. And you look at the photos and just think he was 23, 24, 25 when he did that. The same age as my boys are. And I think what I was doing at that age, I mean, well, I was at St Mary's College.
Yeah, that's right. I was thinking about that.
I was lying to Sister Elizabeth. And he was in the jungle administering justice. And, you know, some of the stuff that he brought back, artifacts he brought back, and bows and arrows and wooden, you probably wouldn't get them through customs now.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, as I sit here talking to you in the corner of the room here, there's a whole cluster of things. But they were actually exhibits in murder trials where they had payback killings. So one village would raid the next village and they'd kill people. And they were just, the Kookookookas were just coming out of cannibalism.
Yeah.
When a native woman's, a Kookookooka's husband would die, she would wear his intestines, his dried intestines around her neck for a year.
My God.
They'd smoke the bodies in a tree. They can bury them. They smoke them in a tree. This is very primitive culture. And he's got photos of all of these things. I mean, it was first encounter. And I often would think as a young boy and then as a young man, my brother would as well, how would we have gone in that environment? What must it have been like exploring and the responsibility and the and the fun and the challenge of getting it daily and living in that environment. And the blokes that he was working with were, he was very young. They were all former officers, you know, from the war, who in a way still couldn't settle down. They'd been traumatized by the war or didn't want to come back into normal society. So these were highly experienced men in their own right, who'd led men in combat, who'd seen death, but who now wanted, in a way, to put themselves outside of society. So that was the life that they chose.
Wow, what an interesting thing. And were those diaries ever published or?
No, we've still, in fact, as I say, I'm sitting here looking at a whole pile of them in the corner of what his records were. And they're a mixture between what he was feeling as a young man and in his notes about, little anthropological notes of, you know, and jotting down words and also trying to record their creation myths about how these people thought they were created from the god in the sky. They're really interesting diaries. They're fantastic. I was really influenced, obviously, by my dad and what he'd done. And he was a good man. He was a strong. He was a strict. He in turn was a strict father for us, for Andy and me and Jenny and Fiona. And he came down and ran businesses. You know, he was trained in a way to run businesses. Mm. He was a manager, but he worked in Flinders Lane with running a large national business for years. But eventually he wanted to move to the bush, so we bought land out of Warrandyte. That's where we really grew up, in Warrandyte, next to a national park with our own acreage as well. And it was like growing up, you know, we had the river and native animals and everything next to us. So it was our own little version of exploring.
What a fascinating life, and what a fascinating kind of, you know, introduction to adulthood, being in that situation for him.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you ask who's influenced you, at the risk of boring your siblings. I mean, another one who influenced me, and I probably never thought about it till now, was we had two teachers at school. One, I talked about one who sort of I felt was picked on, but we had two great teachers. One was called Mr. Moore, and when I was in grade six, he would climb through the window of, you know, he had form teachers, and they take every subject in those days. He'd climb through the window occasionally dressed as a Roman centurion. And then he would lead the class. Then the whole class would be about, the whole day would be about what it was like in ancient Rome.
Wow.
And once a week, every Monday, he would come in and he would read us. I mean, I mentioned King Solomon's Mines. Mm. That's what he read to us over a whole year. This is a teacher. You wouldn't do this now.
Yeah.
He read us chapter by chapter. He read us King Solomon's Mines. And he started at the first chapter, Rudyard Kipling, and he read all of the way through to the end over the course of the year. And it was the most extraordinary year. He read the parts in, you know, the different voices. And I still remember that so vividly. And he had a whole class.
That's great.
I mean, the class, I would have been 35 boys, all, you know, what would it be, being 12, 11? And we were mesmerized.
Mm.
Who would have thought that someone just reading a story to a group of boys could mesmerize us? And he had us spellbound for a year. And I've never really talked about that, but that, to me, that just wasn't great teaching. That was inspirational storytelling about what the power of a story is. And I had another teacher, obviously, Warwick Taylor, his name was. He was like something out of Carnaby Street. And he had long blonde hair. This is at an age when everyone had short hair.
Yeah.
He was like he'd step out of Carnaby Street, and he was, you know, he was very aesthetic. If we'd known better, he'd probably have preferences now that would be clear. But
we were, but
he would read to us Dylan Thomas. And again, he taught us English, but nothing on the syllabus. He'd read us Under Milkwood and he explained Descartes to us about I think, therefore I am. But there was, you know, philosophy wasn't on the syllabus, but he talked to us about Descartes and how Descartes fell asleep by a fire once and couldn't tell when he woke up. And during, when he was asleep dreaming, Descartes had dreamt that he was by the fire and had posed the question, how do we know whether life is a dream and what's reality? and he took us through Descartesian philosophy in a very elemental way. And that was so powerful in its own right. So those teachers, I think, who have custody of young minds and who, instead of just dealing with what's required, inject something further, and that something further being passion, the passion to learn and the passion to teach and the passion to inquire and the passion to ask why, I think that is the greatest gift you can give to people.
Question six, when was the last time you cried and why?
Well, see, you're asking the wrong person, mate, because I am a crier. I cry at the drop of a hat. I cry, I mean, okay, to be specific, Sarah and I went to see, what was the film called? This is embarrassing now. We went to Gold Class on the weekend because Sarah likes rom-coms.
Yeah.
So we loved Gold Class because we just put our feet up and ordered the hot dogs.
Oh, yeah.
So it's fantastic. I remember the first time I went to Gold Class and I put the seat back, I actually reached across to do up my seatbelt like I was on a plane. I just couldn't believe, how good is this? So anyhow, we went to Gold Class last weekend to see this film, Burnt.
Wow.
I can't remember who's in it. Anyhow, it's a story of a chef.
Chef. Bradley Cooper.
Bradley Cooper. And what's her name? Sienna Miller, is that her name?
Yeah, Sienna Miller, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, romantic comedy. Mate, I'm a sucker. I'm crying every time there's anything resembling a setback, a stumbling, a get-together, anything. I tear up. I'm shocking. Yeah, I well up at anything. We were watching a Shirley Temple movie the other night at some ungodly hour on the telly. It's black and white. It's made in about 1935. Bill Bojangles Robinson's tap dancing in it. I'm crying. She's singing I'm on the Good Ship Lolly. I'm pathetic. I'll cry at anything. So, that's the answer. About 5 days ago.
Well, so do I. I don't know if you're aware of that series, Friday Night Lights. About a high school football team. I'm crying all the way through that.
How could you not?
Yeah.
I think in a way that's good because you're in the business of telling stories.
Mm-hmm.
And it shows you that you're attuned to listening to, the emotional meanderings of story. Probably too emotionally attuned, I would have said. <you're right. laughs> But at least, that's probably a better sort of on the calibration scale to be sort of erring on that side than to be, emotionally,
void.
Absolutely, yeah, devoid of anything.
Question seven, what's your current state of mind?
If you were to ask others, I'd probably say as unstable as I've ever been. But in terms of how I see myself, I'd say entirely positive. I'm loving life. I mean, I love waking up every day. I love the prospect of, the sun coming out, of catching up with friends, of planning. I'm a great planner. I'm always looking forward to the next thing to a lunch that we're having or to, something we're doing. And I've always got projects on the go, and they're pathetic. Like, here's one. I'm looking straight out at some trees that have been denuded by possums. So I've spent the last 3 months working out, because I don't like to kill possums, and I know people do, and I don't want to relocate them. I'm completely spent my time thinking, how can I possum-proof those trees? I've got bits of plastic over them. I bought stuff from Bunnings, which gives me a trip to Bunnings, and then I go and buy other stuff and I start other stupid projects. I've always got some pathetically bizarre project on the go. But at the moment, it's possum-proofing the backyard. Writing. I always love planning writing a new project or imagining a new project or thinking about a trip that we might go somewhere or catching up with people or something like that. So
yeah,
my state of mind's entirely positive and driven by the prospect of another stupid encounter.
Question eight, what do you consider your greatest achievement?
Oh, I'd say my five kids and my relationship with them, my family and my wife, my family and my kids. I'd say that beyond anything, that is by far what I enjoy doing in life. It's sort of the center of my life. I mean, you know, maybe stupidly so, but I love catching up with them and I love hearing what they're doing. I've loved it since they were born. I've loved, helping them do things, and I love doing things with them.
Yeah.
I mean, occasionally we'll just, say, who wants to go somewhere? And we'll just go and have one of my kids is in the middle of exams at the moment. So I just picked her up from uni the other day yesterday, and we went up to Tiamo's, which is where I used to have spaghetti and coffee.
Yeah.
So it's exactly the same
I
place. And the son is the son who worked there, remembers me from when I used to come in, and he's the son of the owner that I, Bibi, his name was, and it's the son who's still there. And now he's serving my daughter, who's doing exactly the same stuff as I was. And you know, I don't think anything's changed. The food's the same, the cook's the same.
Yeah.
And uniquely, they've got the old posters on the wall. It's layered in history.
Yes.
So they've got posters from concerts and bands and ballrooms and shows, places like The Last Laugh that are long shut down, still on the wall, like an historical document, like, you know, it's layered. It's almost like Pompeii.
Yeah.
It's like going on a living a culinary dig every time you go into that place. So that, to me, doing things like that, which aren't big, they're just life, to me is so rich. Not that long ago, I said, who wants to go on a trip? And we took three kids who were available. I said, let's just go somewhere. We went to the airport and we just took what we had in our bags and we went down to Tassie for 3 days. And we drove it. We got the cheapest fare we could.
Yeah.
It was a 40-minute flight. We rented the cheapest car we could at the other end. And we drove into the nearest town and had ourselves a great... This is the most embarrassing thing that's happened in a restaurant, Adam. We turned up at this restaurant in Launceston, I think it was, and it was the upmarket restaurant in Launceston, but the three kids and me had just got off the plane. We haven't planned but arrived, and everyone else in the restaurant are all sort of couples on dates and stuff. They've given us a good table because there's four of us,
yes.
And those tables have got candles on, and it's really atmospheric. And they've got those... Everything's handcrafted in this restaurant, and they've got those menus on wooden boards, between two wooden boards you turn over.
Yes.
So I'm reading the menu, and it's kind of dark, so I'm kind of getting close to the candle. And suddenly I'm smelling this horrible burning smell, I didn't realise I was doing it. The board has been under the flame, and then the whole menu board catches fire. We've been in this really elegant restaurant for 3 minutes. There's background music. There's people proposing, and I've managed to start a fire on our table. And I don't mean a little fire. I mean, fire to the wood.
So they've come over
and they've sprayed it out. It was fantastic. And everyone's glaring at you. But, I mean, it was, so I think just doing things with my family. I mean, you know, I'm planning a trip with Sarah at the moment. But even just simple things like a Sunday lunch, I love stuff like that.
Yeah,
I love just catching up with people and having a chat or a cup of coffee or sitting, you know, just things like that. It's kind of pathetic, but it's that minutiae. It's almost like a sort of what are those pointillist paintings where everything's made of little dots?
Yes.
And you stand back and you see one giant picture, but actually it's just an accumulation of tiny dots, and that's how I kind of see life. It's those little dots, each one of those, you know, a lunch, a coffee, a chat, a phone call, a trip. You know, that's to me what is the little dots that make up the bigger picture of life.
Question 9, and this can relate to work or comedy or an actual battle. Who would you want on your side in a battle and why?
That's interesting because to me, I mean, your first thing is to say a battle, someone who's going to be strong and who's going to win. and help you win and all of that. But on reflection, I think probably I'd rather, in a funny sort of way, I'd rather be surrounded by people who I like and who have a certain humanity and who make me laugh and cry and who are forgiving and kind and generous and lose the battle.
Yeah.
but sort of go down with them, with my peeps.
Yeah.
Then really win a battle, as it were. I'd rather be with my people doing our stuff, and lose the battle, because to me, that to me is how I'd rather live life, with the people I'd rather be with, surrounded by the people I'd rather be with. For me, that's my family and my friends. I know that's a pathetic answer.
No, it's a lovely answer.
But it kind of is. It's my mates. It's like, you know, it's all the mates I've been talking about.
Yeah.
It's Tony and you know, Paul and the people at work. I've got great, Mark Clemens and Sean and the people at work that I work with as well, and those areas. And the people, too, that I've been, and Andrew Knight, people I've been lucky enough to work with over the years. And I'd rather be surrounded by people that make me laugh and cry. And there's no deal, or there's no, I can't think of much in life that is worth fighting for that loses them. I'd rather be with them, and the rest, I don't give a stuff about.
Yeah, and those people have with you for a long time,
They have. Sean and... It's funny. I mean, you were talking, I've written this play about Gallipoli, and it's actually the premise of the play is the premise of the play is really simple. It's about it's the centenary of Gallipoli. It's a comedy. I've written the only comedy about Gallipoli, for better or worse, and it may be for worse. Who can say it? But the premise is, and it's actually not about what happened then, it's about how we treat Gallipoli now. So the premise of the play, quite simply, is that the government's decided to put on the pinnacle event for the centenary, being the sort of the crucible of our nationhood, and it's the Royal Command Gallipoli Variety Concert. Oh. And it's in front of the royal family. And as they want to do, they put a military colonel who's just back from Afghanistan in charge of it, the bull from Kabul. But he's inept. He's incompetent at this. I mean, he's brilliant at army stuff, but he couldn't produce a concert to save himself. So they put him with a shiny floor show producer that we know the sort, who's from a show called I'm a Celebrity, Let Me Dance.
Yeah.
And it's the worst coupling you've ever seen. And the concert's looking really bad, and it's going to be beamed live around the nation in 23 allied countries until they discover that there's one last living Anzac, this Clary Flint, which is obviously the conceit of the piece. He'd be ridiculously old. But this Clary Flint, they build the concert around him, and then as they're stuck with him and they've built him into it, they can't go backwards. And as they learn more about him, they learn that he's everything a soldier shouldn't have been. He smuggled contraband in bandages onto the Gallipoli beach. He basically has gambling debts. He watches the dot. It's everything. But ultimately, they find he was dishonorably discharged for... he was court-martialed for disobeying an order. But we'll learn later, and I shouldn't give it away, but I will, that actually it's interesting what constitutes obeying an order and what constitutes a battle. His order was to stand at the bottom of the ladder and to shoot anyone who failed to go over the top, and then, worse still, to shoot anyone who didn't come back down that ladder. And they're the sort of orders that are given in battle. They're the sort of orders that were given in battle. And so, it's interesting you say, who would you like by you in battle, and what orders are worth obeying? Some orders are not worth obeying, I think.
Steve, and the final question is, what would you like your last words to be?
Oh, Christ. What's on a gold class today? Pass the bottle over here. give me a kiss. I've got this idea. That's kind of how I live my life. I've got this idea. And then I'm gone. That'd be my life. Can I tell you, I've just written this thing with Paul Grabowski. It's an opera.
Yeah.
And I think I may have told you this, but this is to me about last words. And it's true. The thing I've written is called Banquet of Secrets, and it's about four people who go to uni and they catch up every year and they have this fantastic meal. And this particular year, they catch up. And they're all my age, so they've lived life and they've all been married, some are divorced, they've got kids and stuff, but they catch up, each of them, religiously every year. This particular year, they pose the question, is it possible that friends as old as we are could still have secrets from each other? And they stupidly say, yeah, well, it's possible. And they stupidly agree over the course of this particular meal to each share a secret they've never told anyone, as each one as each course comes out, and that's the story. As they each tell a secret, and the secrets impact one on each other. But the secret that this is based on is a true secret, and it's the final secret. Giving the plot away, I shouldn't, but it's actually based on a real meal that I had, and it was a real meal I had at Port Douglas. And a friend of ours was not well. They'd been undergoing chemotherapy. And they said, can we borrow your holiday house at Port Douglas? And Sarah and I said, yeah, no problems. And they were going to take it after we finished. So they came up a day early and stayed at the bottom of the hill. And they said, can we take you out to thank you for letting us use the holiday house over the next couple of weeks when we stayed? And we said, yeah, that'd be great. And they booked this place called On the Inlet, which is this great restaurant in Port Douglas.
Mm.
And it was just, and they picked us up, Sarah and me and the other couple, and he looked terrible. He'd been undergoing chemotherapy. And he was in the food industry. He took us down and he booked the best table, and he'd worded up the chef, and he'd got the best food, and he'd ordered a tasting menu. And he brought wine up from home, like the best French wine, beautiful French wine, lots of bottles and all different sorts. And so this meal unfolded. We started midday and we'd have a taste, and he couldn't eat much, but he'd had a taste. So he'd have a taste of veal, and he'd have a little taste of this pepper sauce, and he'd have a taste of this particular, you know, potato. And then the next thing, he wanted just a little bit of prawn and a bit of the sauce to go with it. And so it went. And he tasted. And then he started saying to the waiter, could you bring me some basil leaves? And the waiter said, just what? Now, have you got any? Just ask the chef for some raw basil leaves. And so the waiter brings them back. And he'd just have a nibble on that. And so it went. We finished at 7 o'clock that night. And he tasted and tasted everything. And it was a weird, and with every taste, he'd tell a story. He'd say, I remember when I was growing, he was French. I remember growing up we'd go to the Dordogne and the skies were boundless blue and we'd chase rabbits and it was the most beautiful. And then he'd taste a carrot, a honeyed carrot, and he'd say, I remember the first time I had a honeyed carrot, and it was when I'd just gone to England. And he'd tell a story about that. It was full of stories and full of tasting. And then the sun was coming down and the boat started to come back into the Port Douglas Harbour. It's the most beautiful, beautiful day, evening. Clear sky, you could see the stars. And then as night came, we drove them and dropped them back at the motel. We said, we'll come up and pick the keys up tomorrow morning. Well, 6 o'clock the next morning, we got the phone call, and it was from his wife. And she said he died that night.
Wow.
And it was the most, it put that dinner, that lunch, into a context, in the context of it being the most powerful banquet, powerful Last Supper, the most powerful remembrance and the most powerful goodbye that one could imagine. And that's what it was. It was literally a Last Supper for him. And I think,
yeah,
as I've reflected on that over the years, I think he must have known that he was dying and that he was saying goodbye. And what a way to say goodbye, with friends in the most beautiful location, eating the most perfect food and remembering all the flavours that have made up your life. And, you know, as we were talking about before, if your life is indeed a pastiche, a montage of all of those moments together, then in a way he'd recreated them in one almost perfect meal.
We have ignition sequence start.
Short distance, high impact.
5, 4, 3, two. All engines running.
10 questions with Adam Zwar. Big names, great minds.
Make yourself a cup of tea.
Liftoff. We have liftoff.